From the land of Grand Hyatt University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 9th day of December, 2022. It's USDA Report Day. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about those world agricultural supply and demand estimate figures with Mike Zuzlow. He's at GlobalCommResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Gary Schnitke will be here with updated crop budgets for 2023 and per acre incomes for both corn and soybeans. We'll hear about the Farm Bill in 2023. As well, and the debate around the changing climate, more importantly around conservation and what farmers might be paid to help mitigate climate change. And then as we close out our time together, we'll talk about the weather forecast. That with Eric Snodgrass from Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. It comes to you from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
March corn today at $6.44, a penny and a half higher. The May contract at $6.45 and a quarter up one. In December of next year at $5.93, down a penny and a half. January soybeans 2.5 lower at $14.83 and three quarters. The March at $14.88 and a quarter down two. And November beans $13.98 and a half, three quarters of a cent higher. Bean meal up $5.20. The bean oil down $1.30. Soft red winter wheat at $7.34 and a quarter, 12 cents lower in the March, and the hard red March at $8.33, down 11 and three quarters. Live cattle futures at $155.55, $1.62 and a half higher. The January feeders at $183.92 and a half, 45 cents higher, and lean hogs for the day at $84, down 70 cents for 100 pounds. Mike Zuzlow is now here with GlobalCommResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Hi, Michael. Can you take me through the WASDE figures as they were released from the United States Department of Agriculture? That's the WASDE, or World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates, this morning at 11 a.m.
You bet, Todd. Thanks for having me. Corn ending stocks for the domestic market, 1.257 billion. Close to the average trade guess. That is higher, and that was due to a reduction in exports, probably factored in or expected by the trade. U.S. soybeans at 220 million bushels, unchanged from last month, and a bit lower than the average trade guess from the news wires. Wheat ending stocks domestically, 571 million tons, again unchanged from November, and that too was lower than the average trade guess on most of the news wires. For the world numbers, the corn probably got the best number of all, 298.4 million metric tons, low end of the trading guess, and takes you below last month by a little over 2 million tons. Soybeans at 102.71 million tons, about a half a million tons, plus or minus, lower than last month, and right around within a half million ton of the average trade guess. And then the wheat ending stocks globally, 267.33 million metric tons, almost smack dab on the average trade guess, and about a half a million tons less than November's numbers.
So the corn number was good on the world side. However, domestically, USDA taking away 75 million bushels out of the export figures. A little surprising given the number that you gave us from the world side. And just adding those back in, of course, to what we have for ending stocks. Why do you suppose that happened?
Yeah, good question. And this is where the December report is. We think it's going to be a sleeper report, but it hardly ever is if you really look into the numbers. And so what the USDA did, an interesting dynamic, one that I would maybe question a bit here. They came in with major exporters of both corn and wheat and took those numbers down for their production. But those same major exporters, their exports went up. So, for instance, in the corn, major exporters' production went down 5.5 million metric tons due to a 4.5 million metric ton cut in Ukraine production and a 1 million metric ton cut in Russia production. So kind of the heart and soul of why we're not getting the demand right now, other than the fact that Brazil's shipping to China in the corn market. But USDA said, well, wait a minute, even though Ukraine's production's down 4.5 million, they're going to bump up their exports by 2 million. And so the net was you didn't get the production decline as much as you would have thought when it followed through into the ending stocks numbers. And again, they did that in the wheat. They took 2 million metric tons away on production, but they added 2.5 in exports. And I think that was one of the probably one of the three reasons why wheat ended up making new daily lows on the close.
All in all, did it change the complexion for corn, soybeans, or wheat today?
No, I don't think so. I think the only thing it did, Todd, was solidify my mindset that because USDA did not change the Brazilian soybean production, and you and I have talked about this with CONAB and the USDA relationship and how they usually train after one another. CONAB came out with a bigger production. USDA did not follow it today. And I think that sets you up with a situation where the beans are probably at a level now, if they want to go through $15, they're really going to need the corn and the wheat underneath them, because this report did not hurt the corn and the wheat, if you ask me.
So we're still pretty tight on corn. Will it manage to make a move higher then?
Well, I think it should. I mean, and this is where we're even tighter on wheat. We're still at a 15-year low in world wheat ending stocks, and Argentina's numbers probably going to drop again in January. And I think it really boils down to is that the overshadowing of this market continues to be the Chinese COVID policy and the Federal Reserve. We have an inkling of the Chinese COVID policy now. The refusal to be locked down anymore is reverberating. Copper made a new, I think, 6-month high today on the close. So now we have the Federal Reserve next week. And so that demand low you and I have been talking about in wheat and corn, I can see it in the numbers because of reduced production in Ukraine. I can see it on some of the export data. Now I want to see the Federal Reserve policy get more neutralized here.
Do you suppose there'll be a half point, a quarter point? Jerome Powell's pretty clearly said not 0.75 points, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the trade's kind of still baking into the cake a 0.75-point hike just because of the U.S. economic data that we've seen this week. But between what Jerome Powell said, as you say, and the global economic data, especially in light of what we're finding out about China now, I would think that the Federal Reserve, even though they're our U.S. central bank, they do talk to the World Bank, they do talk to the IMF, they do talk to the other major central banks. I would think they'd keep it at a half point and actually pull back the reins about what they're going to do first thing in 2023 and maybe say something in their wording or their press conference. We'll take a look at it based upon the data. I think that would be a friendly market connector and probably keep that dollar weaker, crude oil stronger, and then we'll see if the wheat can't pick it up from there.
Crude oil stronger, but it's would have to come off some recent lows, I suppose.
Very much so. And that's where the wheat and the WTI have really been trading almost neck and neck with one another, not unlike wheat and copper up until the past, 6 weeks ago. And I think that's where the market's kind of taken the mindset that if we're going to see China go into a recession, we've done the damage in copper. We haven't done enough damage in the wheat and in the crude oil yet. So that's probably the biggest dynamic that we'll have to face as we come back next week and hear what the Federal Reserve has to say.
You think China will go into a recession?
I do think they will. I think they already are, quite frankly, because they're already talking about more monetary stimulus. But as a centrally planned economy, they can pull a couple levers and take themselves out of a nosedive maybe faster than what we could just because of how they transmit their money. So my sense is that they're going to really get active on trying to pull themselves out of a deep recession.
Thank you much.
Thanks, Todd. Have a great weekend.
You too. Mike Zuzulo is with GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. The 2023 Farm Bill debate has already begun, and climate change, or the changing climate, and how agriculture impacts it, and more importantly, what agriculture can do to help mitigate the effects, is on the agenda. That, according to former U.S. Deputy Secretary Chuck Connor at a recent Farm Foundation forum.
I believe that this farm bill that we're debating in 2023 will need to be able to carry a label as the most climate-friendly bill that we have ever passed in the Congress in terms of agriculture.
There are differing opinions about the debate, and that depends a lot on which side of the aisle you might be looking at it from. Here's what incoming Republican House Ag Chair G.T. Thompson had to say.
We don't need a climate change title in the Farm Bill. And I'll be honest with you, what we need to do is give credit to the American ranchers, farmers, foresters for what they do. For too long, there's been a bullseye right on the back of all these families that work so hard to provide us food and fiber that says climate criminal.
And that means that there's something that farm leaders do agree upon. That's conservation incentives, not dictates. Jonathan Kappas from the University of Illinois, he's an ag policy specialist, was at the Farm Forum as well.
Let the innovators compete. Let them go after it and do what they want. not one size fits all. It gives them a shot to do it. We're not going to sort of shoehorn a climate change set of policies across the entire space. What we're talking about is really the option at the farm level. And if you want to go chase a climate market, here's a backstop to help you do so.
The Inflation Reduction Act has some $16 billion for conservation programs like EQIP, CSP, and RCCP, but COPPA says it's not free money.
This would require eliminating some of the spending from the Inflation Reduction Act as an offset because we increase spending somewhere else.
And Jonathan Kappas from the U of I admits the final decision is up to the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, while Connor predicts a heavy, heavy lift for the next farm bill, even without the climate debate. Gary Schnitke, agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I, now joins us to discuss his latest pinnings for the FarmDoc Daily website at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. This time around, he has updated the crop budgets for the 2023 growing season. Gary, I suppose this is because prices are still higher in Chicago.
Yeah, so we released these in August, and then we've updated these in December, and we may again in March. So we'll see what March holds. But the primary, we increased our prices on our budgets, and we increased some costs, not many, but some costs, and we had most of the cost increases in there last time. But the big increase was on prices. We went from $5.30 on corn to $5.60. And we went from $12.70 on soybeans to $13.40 on soybeans. So we've seen fall bids roughly in that area. And the CBOT, is our CME, is now in that area. So we put those up. We decided to increase those prices up to those levels.
You made a couple of other changes. What were they?
So the other one was we increased fuel cost a bit. $2 an acre, but we had large increases in fuel cost in there already. And we also increased interest rates a bit. Now, a lot of that will depend on, obviously, how much debt is needed this year. We'll see where that all goes, but we increased both of those. All our cost of it had gone up considerably from last year. So, yeah, so we just updated those budgets.
Does that all make next year a tough income year for farmers or an okay income year?
So I would describe it as okay. It's going to, if you look at our projections, we come down considerably. And just to give you a feel, corn was $373 farmer return in 2021, $340 in 2022, and we're down to $72. So pretty large decline. That 72 is still above what we had in 2014 through 2018. So okay income year, but not as good as the last couple.
And soybean?
Soybeans, we again are looking down. 2021, we had $270 per acre. 2022, we're projecting $175. In 2023, we're down in the 90 range. So again, coming down, but still above that from 2014 through 2018 averages. So we're projecting both of those down. That's largely because of lower prices. Actually, our 2022 prices are higher than our 2023 prices. And cost have gone up. So it's sort of a price decline and cost increase, a cost price squeeze, so to speak.
In late summer, early fall of this year, you began to tell producers that they might want to lock in some prices for corn to cover input cost. Is that still the case?
Yeah, and we are raising prices, and I would still say it's a good policy to sell a higher proportion of your corn and soybeans at this point of the year than you usually do. Again, we're looking at very high cost, and so any decline in price can result in losses. And just to give you a feel, we're calling break-even prices at $5.28 for corn and $12.13 for soybeans. I mean, those are pretty high break-even prices, and we could see actual prices below that if we have high yields in both Brazil and the United States. So, yeah, it seems prudent to sell more at what are historically above average prices.
Thank you much, Gary.
You're welcome, Todd.
Gary Snitke is an agricultural economist on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. You can find him online with a new article most Tuesdays at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. The latest penning takes a look at the 2023 crop budgets and updates prices there, reflecting what the current Chicago Board of Trade and CME Group numbers are for corn, soybeans, and wheat. On this Friday, let's check in on the agricultural weather forecast, as we always do, with Eric Snodgrass. He's at Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible. Hi, Eric. Thank you for being with us. You've got a busy day. You're not traveling across the Midwest. You're right here in the state of Illinois, I think, over the noon hour at Yoder's in Arthur. Is that right?
Yeah, but unfortunately, I missed lunch. So I just got to wander in from there and start speaking. And I really wish I could have grabbed some food before I get going. But whatever. It's all right.
That's all right. Well, let's see what we're going to talk about today. I'm going to guess that you'll talk about drought. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a good place to start, because when we think about the fact that the new drought monitor still shows the country in about, it's over 78% of the land area still in drought. You know, we just have this ongoing question that you and I will be discussing for the next several weeks, which is, what does that look like by the time we get to April? Now, we already had one system come through, and the first system did bring, of course, rain around this area and some snow in Iowa and South Dakota and maybe a little snow in northern Illinois. But the thing that we're going to have to watch is this next system that on Saturday is diving into California, it gets cut off. Okay, now what that means is main jet stream flow runs right over the top of it, and it just sits there and spins. And what it means is it's going to take 7 days to go from California to Maine. So that means it's going to go slowly across the country. There'll be some severe storms to the south. There's going to be big snows coming through the western mountains, and then big snows in the northern plains. But when you look at the whole thing, it's putting down moisture almost everywhere across the country, except the high plains where the drought is the deepest. And that's where the big problem area is. And it seems to continue to be the area as we look out there over the next, several weeks going forward.
Speaking of several weeks, what does the end of December look like here in the United States and the beginning of January?
Well, I feel like for a while now, I've been calling for cold air to finally get here. And it hasn't, right? I mean, we just haven't been able to get the cold air out of the Canadian prairie, out of the Northwest, and all the way down here. But it does appear that after the 15th, about a week from now, that we'll finally unlock that and start to see some of that cold air migrating. So we could have a cold and snowier end of the year. To be honest, that increases our chances of even a white Christmas. But all I care about here is that moisture is coming back. And in a state like Illinois, so overall, that is just a good outlook for Illinois, the state of Illinois. Just the fact that if we get the moisture now, we can lock it into the soil. It'll be there when comes spring. And overall, that's just a very positive message that we're getting from the long-range forecast models.
Let's turn your attention not to South America yet, but to Europe. Are you worried still about winter weather there, especially for those folks in Ukraine and the rest of Western Europe, as they're paying really high prices for energy?
Yeah, I'm not seeing moisture problems in Ukraine or the Russian wheat belt for this winter. The big thing we're thinking about, though, is that the Siberian snowpack, the Canadian snowpack was really big in November. And what that's done is that's created a lot of what we call high latitude blocking. That's big ridges of high pressure that are just sitting over, the Arctic and Canada and Siberia. So what that does is that allows for much easier transport of really cold air to come across both Europe and the United States at the same time. So the next 10 to 15 days across Europe is looking colder. The time period of like December 20th to January 20th is looking colder. We just see a lot of indications that the northern hemisphere is going to see good shots at colder weather this upcoming winter, and it's going to start here pretty soon.
And finally, your assessment of South America.
Well, yeah, I heard a lot of folks lately talking about drought in Brazil, and I cannot find it. Now, there have been a few places that have had a little bit lower than normal precipitation, but for example, if in the last 30 days they missed out on 3 inches of rainfall, they probably still got 10. You know what I'm saying? So it's a matter of perspective here. So they can go with less rainfall in Brazil and still have a good crop. And a lot of us are still estimating a very large crop out of Brazil. The problem areas in Argentina, where they just went through a hot week, they're still in that hot week. There's some scattered storms coming tomorrow, but that's all they are. When you look at some of the drought indicators in Argentina, what you can see here is that there's some of the driest conditions we've seen in better than 20 years. And in addition to that, the satellite view of their NDVI values is record low going back to the year 2000. So if I had to point my finger at a problem spot somewhere in the southern hemisphere, it is definitely going to be Argentina. But I think Brazil, unless something crazy happens that none of us are foreseeing right now, Brazil could really make up a lot of that ground, which will be lost in Argentina.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you bet.
Eric Snodgrass is with Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible. Joined us on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Don't forget, you can always find our Commodity Week program online to listen to anytime you'd like if you can stay with us on our home station. That's coming up next. Otherwise, many of these radio stations will play it over the weekend, and it's up at willag.org right now.
From the Illinois State Water Survey at the University of Illinois Prairie Research Institute, this is Illinois State Climatologist Trent Ford. The first full week of December was mostly dry and mild across Illinois. Average temperatures range from the upper 20s in northern Illinois to the low 40s in southern Illinois, near to 1 degree below normal. November as a whole was about half degree warmer than normal, wrapping up a beautiful fall season that was just slightly cooler than normal overall. Most folks picked up some rain this week, with totals ranging from around a tenth of an inch in far eastern Illinois to nearly 1.5 inches in far southern Illinois. Even though exactly zero people enjoy a 40-degree rain, wetter weather is much needed across the Prairie State because statewide average November precipitation was only 58% of normal, about 1.3 inches below normal. The drier November added deficits from September and October, making for the 23rd driest fall on record statewide and a top 10 driest fall season on record for most southern Illinois counties. Over the past 3 weeks, the U.S. Drought Monitor has maintained severe to extreme drought in southern Illinois and expanded moderate drought in central and northern Illinois. Looking ahead, the wetter weather looks to stick around for at least the next week. Forecasted 7-day totals through next Friday exceed 1.5 inches for the entire state, with some isolated higher totals in southern Illinois. The precipitation will likely fall in multiple events next week and may be in a mixed rain-snow form for central and northern Illinois. Meanwhile, temperatures next week will continue to be on the mild side, with highs in the 40s statewide. Farther out, the latest week 2 outlook from the Climate Prediction Center, taking us through December 22nd, shows higher odds of a move back to colder and drier than normal conditions for late December. This is Illinois State Climatologist Trent Ford, wishing everyone a happy, healthy weekend.